Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so you know earlier we got an update on U.S. inflation showing signs of moderating in April, giving the Fed maybe room to pause.
Moderate.
I know.
I mean, come on.
So we're splitting hairs here. All right, let's get into it. Because two folks who know a lot about it and have a lot to say about it is Bloomberg's Mike McKee and Dartmouth's Danny Blanchflower. Mike, of course, Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent, who's been up for like 24 hours straight talking about this. He's on the phone in New York City. Danny, Dartmouth Professor of Economics, former member of the Bank of England's Interest Rate Setting Monetary Policy Committee. He's a labor economist. He's with us from Zoom in Hanover, New Hampshire. Folks, thank you so much for being with us. Mike, I want to start with you. You were on early, breaking it down as the numbers crossed. You've had hours to go over all of the data points. What are the key facets of this report?
Well, I think I said this earlier, and it really is the case that this was a status quo report. It didn't move the ball much one way or another. We saw inflation move up a little bit on a headline basis, largely because of the energy. We saw the core rate not go down very much, largely because of housing. And these are stories that we have seen before. So this isn't going to change the way the Fed is looking at the overall economy and looking at the fight against inflation. They can still pause in June, but it won't be because of this report.
So we saw for the first time an inversion, or the first time in many months, an inversion of the headline figure, which is now lower than the core figure. Does that mean anything, or does it just look cool on a chart, Mike?
I think it looks cool on the chart, Matt. The biggest thing is that we're going to see core start to come down when the drop in rental prices over the past year finally starts to show up in the data, which should be in the next month or so. But the core is the core for a reason. It is the stickier parts of inflation, and the headline numbers largely influenced by things like inflation and food, although food wasn't a big factor this time, but energy and food. Energy prices went right up. They've started to go down again, so we'll probably see a change next month.
All right, Danny, come on in on here. You've been very clear on how you feel about what the Fed's been doing here, but do you feel like inflation is slowly, it's certainly better than it was a year ago?
Wait, how does he feel? Danny, how do you feel about what the Fed's been doing here?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that the reality, I mean, Mike laid it out very well and very carefully. The reality is that what's most astonishing is that everybody seems to have such a kind of accepted view. Everybody seems to think the same. All the central banks are saying the same things, and the reality, you know, and we have unanimous votes. And the reality is, we just don't really know. There's no fundamental theory here as to what's going on. What we see is inflation starting to fall. Today, basically, what you got was the base effects for this month stop working. So you dropped a 0.4 and you got a 0.4. And in the seasonally unadjusted, you get a drop. In the seasonal adjustment, you get it to stick at 5. So the next 2 months, we're going to have big base effects dropping out. And I think, in a sense, the discussion has to actually be, so what are the costs of inflation? I mean, we all sort of sit around and go, yeah, that's what the Fed's got to do. Inflation's such a terrible thing. Well, actually, enumerate what a terrible thing it is. Yeah, well, I know that inflation lowers well-being, and I've measured a great deal of it. But the question is, what do you replace it with? And what are the costs and the consequences of overly tightening? And the answer is that a 1% rise in unemployment is between 5 and 10 times worse on ordinary people than a 1 percentage point change in inflation. So essentially what we're going to see is how much the consequences of what they're doing are much worse than the problem of inflation.
So Danny, you don't think we can have maybe a recession, though, with a labor market that is still strong?
Well, I don't even believe this thing about strong. I think it's kind of nonsense. I mean, the reason I think it's nonsense is that the unemployment rate no longer is a decent measure of anything. So I've worked on this forever. Mm-hmm. The unemployment rate is uncorrelated with wage growth. It's uncorrelated with it. The biggest macro problem you have is to explain why wage growth was so flat between 2010 and 2020 when unemployment was falling. Answer, unemployment rate is irrelevant. What you have here is lots of labor market slack currently being indicated by the non-employment rates and the labor force inactivity rates. That's what's determining wage growth and keeping wage growth down. If you try and look at every country in the world, every other country other than the US, the EPOP, the employment to population rate, is at least equal to its rate in 2000. The UK is well above it. Greece is even comparable. So the question you have to ask yourself, and to which I don't have a great answer, and we can discuss it, is why is it true that the non-employment rate in the US suggests to get back to 2000 levels, you need about 7 million more people working? So on that basis, I don't believe the unemployment rate, because nobody can show me anything that it's related to wages. I have lots of papers on it. And why is the US so much different to everybody else? So the argument you have to raise rates because the labor market's so tight is for the birds.
So let me ask you this, because, you know, in Econ 101, I was mostly thinking about keggers and the Grateful Dead. But why is it that, you know, the Fed wants to use unemployment and a recession to fight inflation is what I get. They're saying we have to fight this inflation and we're going to have to accept a recession and higher unemployment in order to do that. And you say a higher unemployment is actually much worse than higher inflation, right? Why is that? Because inflation affects all of us, right? And unemployment only affects a very small
portion. No, that's completely wrong, actually, it turns out.
Okay.
Obviously, a lot of keggers still in his life. I'm just going
to
say that.
I remember talking to Charlie Evans, who told me, when I showed him these estimates, he said to me, Danny, this is great. Everyone told me always what you just said, that inflation hurts everybody. It's like 30 times worse than unemployment. So here's the story. We go measure it. You ask people about your well-being and you say, so how much does inflation hurt you? So think about a 1 percentage point rise in inflation against a 1 percentage point rise in unemployment. Well, you get a number for the inflation. What you get in unemployment is, well, 1% of people are unemployed. So those people's unemployment rises a lot and they're really unhappy. Great. But what happens is a 1 percentage point rise in unemployment makes people much more unhappy than a 1 percentage point rise in inflation. Now, you can argue, I don't like this, but you can say, this is the evidence. This is the data. Nobody else has any other data. Everything else about, they worry about inflation and inflation expectations is just dreamed up, stuff up. This is the data. Yeah. The data says a 1 percentage point rise in unemployment. Well, there's a new paper by Robert McCulloch from New Zealand just come out, says that a 1% rise in unemployment raises pain 10 times more than a 1 percentage point rise in inflation. I mean, the problem for anybody who says that's wrong is they have no data. This is the only data that exists. Well, and it shows that the impact of our unemployment or joblessness is much worse. So I'm still waiting for people to tell me, what are the consequences of an inflation rate at 5% that you're trying to get down by creating something much worse?
Mike, tell him.
Hang on a sec. Mike, come on in, our other economist.
Well, the obvious consequence is that people lose purchasing power and their standard of living goes down. And we saw that specifically during the 1980s great inflation, which is what scared the pants off of all the central bankers who are now trying to bring down inflation. But I was struck, Danny, by what you were saying about wages. Wages are still rising at a very high pace, especially compared to what they were doing in the teens. We're still well over 4%, and inflation is still running above that level. So people are still losing grounds, even though they are getting raises at this point.
Danny, got about 20 seconds, though, unfortunately.
Well, real wages are flat over the last year. And obviously, for the level of the unemployment rate, wage growth is actually still very compressed. I mean, in the past, you had an unemployment rate of 3.5. You'd be talking of wages greater than that. So the answer is that the unemployment rate is uncorrelated with wage growth. Just get it into everyone's heads. It's completely uncorrelated with it. It has no relationship with wage growth whatsoever. You can't run it in any form of wage growth, be it a Phillips curve or anything else, or a wage curve. The unemployment rate is uncorrelated with wage growth.
We got to run. We'll
I'm tweeting that, though. I'm going to tweet that because I think that's the most fascinating thing that I've heard today.
All right. We got to say goodbye to Danny and to, of course, our Michael McKee, Danny Blanchflower over at Dartmouth.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
If you drive a car, car,
I tax the street.
If you drive to six,
I'll tax your seat.
If you get too cold,
I'll tax the heat.
All right, everybody. Well, shares of H&R Block selling off today, hitting its lowest level in about a year. This is after the company cut its outlook for the year after reporting lower earnings and revenue in its fiscal third quarter. So let's get into the quarter. Let's get into the business. This is a company that's been transforming itself over the last couple of years. Back with us is Jeff Jones, President and CEO at H&R Block. We've mentioned in the past his background, Chief Marketing Officer over at Gap, Target, President of Ridesharing at Uber. Formerly, Jeff joining us via Zoom from Kansas City, Missouri. Jeff, good to have you back here with myself and Matt Miller. Talk to us about the quarter, the outlook. What's going on?
Yeah, well, first of all, Carol, we definitely have not hit our 52-week low. So I want to be clear about that. Listen, the season did not end the way we expected it to. There were multiple industry dynamics at play. Our assisted business was a little softer than we wanted. But there are many, many things that went well this year. And I think that's what investors are hearing. You know, we still expect to grow earnings and EPS in a really tough backdrop. Our DIY strategy worked. We introduced AI. So, you know, there are many things that are working, but we were clear on the call yesterday. There were three reasons why our volume didn't deliver, and we feel like we got a really good handle on that.
What do you think investors are getting wrong here? Because, I mean, if it was a week later, you'd be at your 52-week low, right? I mean, just because you had an incredible May in 2022 in terms of the stock, why are investors not understanding your optimistic view?
You know, I think like any company that has an unusual mix of business and seasonality, it's just hard to get your mind around that so much of our business happens in one quarter. You know, I think for some
people... It's been that way for how many years? Since like 1913?
Well, not quite that far. I mean, we have a very, very large and healthy tax business, and that's determined by one time a year. So I think that, you know, when you look at our financials and you see us lose money in most quarters of the year, but then generate $500 or $600 million of free cash flow, I think the investors that take the time to really understand the story take a great long-term view on how we allocate capital, our dividend, our share repurchase, and it's a really good story.
All right. And just to clarify, I'm just looking at some data on the Bloomberg. It does say you're at the lowest level since about May 12th of 2022.
Yeah, that's why I said it's a week. Yeah. If it was a week later, it would be the 52-week low. You're at your 51-week low. Let's put it that way.
We're not $25.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. You are the CEO, you know, but I just wanted to clarify in terms of the data. Having said that, you guys are going through a transformation. And Jeff, when we last talked in terms of, I think it was back in August, we talked a little bit about the impact of higher rates. Tell us about the folks on your platform, whether it's individuals, whether it's small business. In terms of the activity you are seeing, what is it telling you about them and what it tells you about the broader outlook?
Well, I think the biggest thing we see is really the health of the consumer, especially. You know, we saw this year the tax industry got off to a really fast start. People were looking for their money. We saw these refund advance loans really perform well this year in the industry. That speaks to the cash needs of the American consumer. The problem is for many, many Americans this year, refund sizes were down, you know, 8 to 9%. And many people who are used to getting a refund suddenly found themselves owing money. So those kind of things are very confusing to the consumer, but we definitely see the consumer needing cash and looking for alternative ways to find it.
Why did a lot of filers see that change? Why were a lot of filers owing money when they normally get a refund? Because I think immediately of the SALT deduction cap, but that went into play in like 2017, 2018.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, keep in mind, giving tax advice is like asking Mayo Clinic for medical advice. Like there's so many things that depend, but there are two broad things that happened. The first is the roll-off of stimulus benefits. Mm. The second is the IRS made a change to withholding tables, which essentially more people kept money in their paycheck, but didn't think about changing their withholding and therefore had a surprise at the end of the year. Those are the two main reasons.
Can I ask, and I'm sure you already have a plan, how can AI help you at H&R Block?
Well, first of all, there are many things we're already doing with AI. We use it in robotics process automation on remedial tasks. We use it to match labor and supply and scheduling. This year, we introduced an industry first in our DIY product, where if you switched from a competitor, we automatically and proactively looked at last year's return to identify any errors that may have been made. And if we found one that was worth more than $250 for you, we notified you so you could file an amendment. So there are a number of things that we're already doing today. And, you know, listen, we have the same broad ethics, regulatory, legal, security and privacy concerns as I think many companies do. But in general, we're excited about the potential for what this technology can do for customer service, et cetera.
I mean, can't AI make the tax code easier for humans to deal with? I remember Donald Rumsfeld's famous letter to the IRS where he was like, I have no idea and I have a college degree. Like my wife doesn't know either. So here you go. Can't this make it easier for Americans to file their taxes by themselves?
You mean basically talk to a bot and just do it?
Yeah. Talk to an H&R AI bot. And it'll say, I file your taxes and it's all done, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think what obviously has to happen is whatever average means, the average American consumer has to be willing to turn over all of their most intimate financial data to the bot. And,
for the average American consumer, that's like a W-2. Here's my 1099, all done.
It's really not a W-2. Think about the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, the way childcare happens.
Right.
Are you a grandparent, a parent, an aunt or an uncle taking care of the child? I mean, there's an enormous amount that goes into this for the consumer every year, way beyond a W-2. There's no question this technology can help all of us provide better tax planning and make things faster. We're already leaning into that. But I think, the jury will be out over many years on will people be comfortable turning over essentially their financial DNA to the computer?
Well, and I guess I would argue, I know what we share with our accountant, and they pretty much know everything and anything when it comes to our finances. So you essentially are handing it right now to a firm, individuals who put it into a database that you know,
my dad would never. My dad would never. Okay. He'll do his own taxes until he dies.
But we are, and so are many other people. So I think it does sound like just kind of the normal progression. Hey, one thing I want to go back to, Jeff, because you do have a vantage point when it comes to your platform. San Francisco Fed coming out with their household survey, and they're saying that households are still strong in terms of the money that they have on their individual balance sheets, despite how many years we are out from the pandemic. Do you agree in terms of what you are seeing? Or do you feel like things are getting a little bit weaker and softer?
You know, what I can speak to, Carol, is the 20 million people that we serve and the last several months of seeing how important it was they got their cash. So does that mean they're excited to get it because they're flush and their bank accounts are full and their credits, their debt is low? Or does it mean, you know, that money's already spent? And what we see with the consumers we serve is that refund is already spent. And so, you know, it's not go on a vacation. So we still absolutely saw this year urgency to get cash and just too many people being surprised by the outcome for those two reasons I mentioned earlier.
Hey, I do want to go to, since you do know when your stock hits a 52-week low, and I was looking at, you know, the moves today, it's down about 4%. It was down 6% at its lows. What are investors saying to you? Because they obviously are disappointed.
Well, first of all, they're excited that we will still grow earnings, we'll still expect to grow EPS. We have a really strong capital allocation program. And when you put all that together, we deliver a really nice TSR. So they definitely see that. I think what they want to know is, you know, why did you lose volume this year? And there are three answers. And we're really clear with this. You know, we lost filers who make less than $5,000 of income, who were most likely in the system because of stimulus. That represents about a third of our client loss. The second is those EITC filers that were looking for refunds, refund advances. And the third, about 20% of our client loss is just due to the California extension timing. So I think the clarity about why we lost volume this year has helped investors understand that two of those three headwinds are behind us, and we're still generating a tremendous amount of free cash flow and deploying that very effectively.
Right, including buybacks, right, and dividend.
Correct. Exactly.
All right. Going to leave it on that note. Hey, Jeff, always fun to check in with you. Jeff Jones, he's president and CEO of H&R Block. Stock is down about 14% so far. You talked about TSR, of course, total shareholder return, joining us from Kansas City, Missouri. So your dad doesn't hand anything over, huh?
No, never. Would never. It's a little worrying, actually.
All right. Gets older. More to come on Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Matt Miller and Carol Masser. We're going to, just like our TV colleagues, stay with Disney because the stock is down about 2.5% in the aftermarket. So let's get to it with Jamie Lumley, senior analyst at Third Bridge Group. They provide global research to PE firms, hedge funds, and consultants on the phone in New York City. Paul Sweeney, co-host of Bloomberg Surveillance and Bloomberg Markets, with us on the phone.
My man.
From New Jersey. He is. Paul, let's start with you. What jumps out for you at Disney?
The first number I went to, the first line item I went to was the streaming losses. Now, the good news is the losses of $659 million came in less than the estimates, which is about $850 million. So that's the good news. The bad news is $659 million is still a huge loss just for one quarter. So I think on the call, investors will want to get a sense from management, you know, where do they see that glide path for that business as it tries to get to break even?
All right, so it looks better than expected. I wonder why, at least, you know, on the headlines, I wonder why we're seeing the drop then in the stock after hours, Jamie, I guess you could never really tell, you know, why investors are buying and selling across global Wall Street. But what do you take out of this that could be bearish?
Well, I think there are definitely a couple of interesting things to look at for revenue. You know, certainly I also first looked to see what the line item was for the loss of in streaming, as that is one of the big stories over the past couple of quarters. And trimming those losses is definitely one of those things which Bob Iger is putting at the top of his to-do list. And certainly I think there is some encouragement to be found in that those losses are being trimmed. But again, it is a large amount of money which is losing. And also coming off the backs of Warner Brothers Discovery last week reporting that their streaming business is starting to turn around a profit, I think there is ongoing pressure to see some slightly more positive results in that segment. However, you know, other things to look at as well is overall revenue seems to be delivering some strong growth, looking at 13% overall top-line revenue growth from the year-ago period. So there are definitely a lot of factors, and I think that as we look at the call later this afternoon, there will be a number of areas where it will be just interesting to see how management is interpreting these results and looking at what are the top priorities that they want to discuss.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, when I look at, you know, streaming, it's still such a smaller business when it comes to what goes on at Disney, Paul. But is it right for Disney? I mean, they have such incredible content, I feel like, and they are really good at usually leveraging across parks and movies and so on and merchandise. Can they figure out how to make this be a lot more productive when it comes to top and bottom lines?
I think they can because, as you mentioned, they have such great programming across their film studios and television studios. They've got arguably the best content on the planet. They, like everybody else, have to, you know, make that migration from the traditional pay TV model to the streaming model. And that is a very expensive transition. And the payoff at the other side is a little bit unknown at this point. So if you're an investor in Disney or some of these other big media companies, you really are making a bet on management to execute here. So, again, that's why these conference calls and these meetings with investors are key because, boy, we see the programming costs really, really high. And you got to really make a stretch to see when this thing turns profitable. And that's why Bob Iger really has been focusing on the cost side of the business as well as the top line.
And to be fair, he gutted, you know, a lot of the folks that were behind Disney Plus initially. So we know he is remaking it in terms of the management.
Wait, Disney Plus, that's the streaming service.
Correct.
So I guess I watched that a lot, but only, only like three films. We watch Encanto, Moana, and Frozen. Well, Frozen 1 and 2. Jamie, what about ESPN?
Well,
this
Marvel
is something that
stuff.
This is something Marvel.
Come on, Matt.
What, am I
get
a kid?
With it. No.
Jamie, what do we think about ESPN? Paul and I talk about this all the time and it feels like they could do a heck of a better job at monetizing that incredible content and they just leave so much money on the table.
You know, it's definitely an interesting question, and looking at ESPN and ESPN Plus, it has definitely been one of those hot-button issues over the last year or so. And looking at, as you highlighted, the value of content there, one of the big questions, of course, around the overall cost, looking at sports rights and renegotiation there, but then also just the best way to monetize that, of course, across the traditional linear channels, as well as the streaming side of things. It is definitely far smaller than Disney's other streaming offerings, and there are some questions about overall as streaming in general continues to see a rise in live sports across a variety of different platforms looking to have that be one of their areas of focus. What exactly Disney will be doing for ESPN Plus and ESPN is a big question. Earlier this year, of course, we heard that Bob Iger is not really entertaining at this point any thoughts about divesting that part of the business. But exactly what the plan is one of those things which our experts continue to say there is some uncertainty around.
I just mean because, you know, a lot of people don't have cable anymore. But the best content that ESPN has is only available on cable. So suckers like me that buy the ESPN Plus service realize later that we can only watch, like, Duke's JV field hockey team, you know? No offense, Paul.
All right.
So, Jamie, what can they do about that?
It's a really good question, and I think that one of the things that we've certainly heard is also just in the general nature of the challenges of sports streaming in general. Because of the seasonality of it, you have just a lot of challenges to the overall fundamental business model of getting sustainable subscribers and not having people hop on for when their team is playing and then immediately leave once the season is over and March Madness is no longer upon us. So for that kind of model,
right,
they're still trying to figure out exactly what to do here.
Yeah, I'm just reading from the press release. Decrease at cable due to higher sports programming and production costs and to a lesser extent lower affiliate and ad revenue. All right, folks, just got about 40 seconds, 20 seconds first to you, Paul. What would you be asking on the call?
Just the streaming business. Give me the updated path to profitability for streaming.
All right, how about for you, Jamie?
I'm still curious to hear what's happening with Hulu. I think that's one of the big question marks coming off of the back of the leadership transition, another of those areas with a lot of uncertainty. So also how that factors into streaming is another big area.
Hulu subscribers, 48.2 million. That is more than ESPN Plus, and that is certainly, let me think.
I get them all in a bundle. I have Disney, Hulu, yeah. ESPN all in a bundle. So I would think that's the same with most people. No.
No, I'm just looking at, you know, what do they do though, right? Because it's just like another channel. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Jamie Lumley, senior analyst on the phone in New York City over at Third Bridge Group, and Paul Sweeney, of course, co-host of Bloomberg Surveillance and Bloomberg Markets, and really our go-to internally when it comes to media. Disney shares, Matt, are down 2.2%. Marvel, you know nothing? Have you not seen any of them?
Captain I'm not America? Into superheroes or comic books.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We've had a lot when it comes to artificial intelligence and certainly the next level AI. We heard Palantir earlier in the week, the CEO, saying in terms of their strategy, they said they're just going to take the whole market. We just talked about it with Ed Ludlow about Alphabet and Google.
IBM's
plans.
Brought Watson back.
IBM has brought Watson back. I mean,
to no fanfare at all.
AI's been around for a long time. It's just getting a lot smarter, and we can actually talk to it, if you will, or talk with it. So let's get another take on AI. With us is Peyvird Sheth. He is co-founder and CEO at the conversational messaging platform for commerce, marketing, and support there called Gupshup, and he's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Peyvird, good to have you here with Matt and myself. Tell us a little bit. You guys are all in on AI. What specifically is it just about when we call a company, you can be behind it in terms of your platform?
Yeah, firstly, Carol, Matt, thanks for having me here. That's exactly right, right? Helping businesses and brands build these conversational experiences or chatbots through which they can engage with customers. So for a consumer, the consumer experience is that chatting with a business is just as easy as chatting with a friend or family member. You ask them questions, and through those conversations, you can get deals, offers, shopping, payments, customer support, troubleshooting, and so on.
I got to jump in here, Peyvird. I should have warned you about Matt.
Well, I have used some chatbots recently with a couple of your clients, for example, Verizon, and the experience I had was nothing like a conversation. In fact, I thought it might have been the dumbest piece of technology that I'd ever interacted with. Now, I was also angry at the time, to be fair, about Verizon, nothing to do with the chatbot. But are you saying that your technology is able to do that stuff now, or that, you know, 5 to 10 years down the road, they should be able to do that?
No, I think it's more like 6 to 12 months now, right? What's changed? Okay, what's fundamentally changed a few months ago is that these large language models was a huge step function in capability, meaning it just dramatic improvement. And all of those are now trickling into these experiences. So it takes a little bit of time, but in the next few, it's a matter of months, because the hard part is done. It just has to be integrated. But the fact that they can handle these conversations in a natural way, understand, interpret, sense what the query is, and then provide good responses, etc. It takes a little bit of work to optimize it for a particular enterprise.
But what was the big jump? What was it all of a sudden? Because AI, as we've said, right, this has been around. But what happened? What was the big jump in particular?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. See, AI, I mean, I did my graduate research 20, 30 years ago in AI, and it's been going around for 70, 80 years, right? AI has been making constant progress out of the limelight. I think what happened literally over the last 6 months was it reached a point, and basically three things came together, right? One is on the software algorithm side, there was ideas around deep learning and the transformer, which was amazing. The other is Moore's law, right? Hardware getting better and faster. And then the third is data, right? Internet data, the volume of data available for training has become available. So these three things together. And then I guess it's just a numeric thing, which is at a certain number of parameters, right? At 100 million, it wasn't good, but at 100 billion parameters, suddenly it understands language.
So it hit some tipping point where all of a sudden it became actually really productive.
So from a media standpoint, it looks like it went from nothing to something. But, but you know, AI research has been going on, making steady progress.
But, I mean, you know, when I talk to a chatbot online at any of these big companies, or if I get a computer on the hotline, it's just a horribly frustrating experience. And your business is very impressive, Gupshup. You have a ton of clients. You have marquee investors. You know, you have a huge $1.4 billion valuation. So I have a lot of respect for that. But I have to guess, when you talk to people who interact with chatbots, they're all as frustrated as I am, because I'm finding myself saying, agent, get me to a human, because I can't get anything done with the, I hate to call it AI, because there's nothing intelligent about the current services.
So I'll answer, there are two aspects to it, right? One is, if we just step away from the US for a second, in the rest of the world where you don't have as many customer support agents, as many businesses investing in these things, for consumers, if their baseline is zero, a chatbot that works half the time is a miracle, right? Because it solves a lot of problems. You don't have to wait on hold. You don't have to wait in long queues and so on. So there's a lot of people around the world.
If your problem is solved. But if your problem isn't solved, then there's another 2 or 3 minutes that you've wasted talking to a chatbot.
But what you're saying is, this is what we're finding. The more information that goes into it, it's going to get better. Because to be fair, like, we've all been in that point where we're
we would
get me out of it.
So, right? I mean, you're saying it's going to improve someday?
No, but now we are on the cusp of it. Okay, because of what OpenAI, and there was just one example, but there are many other models, you know, Meta and Google and even the open source community is just driving it. So it solved the hard part of understanding language, which is the hardest thing. The second bit is packaging it into specific business conversations. That's remaining, but that's now like weeks or months away. We're doing that for a whole bunch of enterprises, you know, and you kind of have to handcraft the integration a little bit, but we are even productizing that.
So how do you protect the accuracy and the purity of the information? So it's not a case of we're doing something, then we're Googling, you know, later on, and we're trying to do our own research.
And that's exactly what takes time, right? These general language models are simple word prediction, meaning they just make up, they're generative, right? So they kind of make up an answer. It may not be accurate. So, but in a business context, you need accurate information. So we do, there's a process called fine tuning. There's something called prompt engineering. And then you also link it to plugins which give you the actual data, right? So, for example, what's the interest rate on a checking account? I mean, you can't make up an answer, even though AI will. So there, it looks up the right answer from the right place, or it
says
it.
How are we going to know as users that it's the right answer?
Well, so the business has the responsibility and the onus to make sure, because they also have the liability for what the bot says, right? So I think this is exactly where we work with them to make sure that the conversations are precise, they're accurate, the information works, and so on. And then there's a lot of debugging and so on, right? Look, the web wasn't built overnight, and neither will these chatbots. But I think as they get optimized and refined, I think it'll be good enough for you, Matt. You
know? I'm looking forward to the future.
You have a little daughter.
I'm still a little bit hurt from my Verizon interaction.
She's going to learn her language. Like, wait, it takes some time.
Exactly.
How busy are you? Just 10 seconds. Are people calling you off the phone, or just give me an idea?
Yeah, this is accelerating. I mean, we are doubling business year over year, and it's accelerating even more. Yeah.
All right. Well, come on back so we can, you know, make Matt happy. Future chat GPT experiences will be better.
Well, even better, the next time I'm here, you'll talk to my chatbot.
Yeah, all right, exactly. He'll do the interviews for you.
All right, we got to run.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast,
Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern
on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube.
You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, so you're crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, under 18 minutes left in today's trading session. We got a two-year note, as we heard from Charlie, still down around 3.9%. But more importantly, well, not necessarily more importantly, but we do have some buying as we get towards the last 20 minutes of trading here. 1.2% higher on the NASDAQ. We're off definitely our lows of the session, at our highs when it comes to the NASDAQ trade. So, that's what's going on. So let's get to it with our Drive to the Close guest. Ellen Lance is back with us, research director at lanceglobal.com, joining us on the phone from Toledo, Ohio. Ellen, nice to have you here with Matt and myself. So it is an interesting day. I've been calling it kind of a meh week of trading because it feels like we're looking for direction. What's your take on where you can find opportunities in this market environment?
Well, I think, Carol, it's a situation where, the market has been presenting opportunities in the beginning of the year with the mega caps, you know, after the mega cap tech stocks were down so much, over the past few weeks. You know, you had companies like Akamai Technology and Google that really are in good spaces that we like cybersecurity and AI, and they really had underperformed, and today both of them are up, and I think investors are realizing, or Wall Street's realizing, that both companies are going to have a significant take as far as in cybersecurity for Akamai and AI, obviously, for Google. So I think that's where you got to avoid the torpedo areas, you know, like the small banks and the regionals, and capitalize on these areas now that might not have performed yet, or in good long-term areas that can do well. And I think that's the type of market we're going to have, winners and losers, and the divergence is going to be pronounced.
Are you worried at all about drop in stocks if we don't have an agreement on the debt ceiling? I look at the, before TARP, we had stocks drop 8%. And in 2011, when the debt, when our debt rating was downgraded, we have stocks drop 20%. So, you know, that could bring us down to 3,700, or could bring us down to 3,300.
Yeah, I think, Matt, we're in the higher end of the range, so I would be a little bit more selective now. And obviously, if something as dramatic as 2011 occurs, I would utilize that as a buying opportunity, but, you know, selectively. So we're not real concerned with it, but we are in the higher end of the range, so it would be, a matter of risk profile to not stretch and chase things here because of, what you said and other geopolitical and interest rates, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of headwinds, and there's no really reason to chase stocks, especially some of these areas have done so well.
But how much of this, the worries, are already factored in?
Well, some of it, is already factored in, Carol, but I think it really depends on the area. I mean, like, energy has gone down quite a bit, so if you think that, we're not going into recession, that might be a good area with China opening up.
Is that economic slowdown, or is that also the shift away from fossil fuels? I know it's a slow shift, but it's happening.
Yeah, I think it's more the economic slowdown and a switch, from a standpoint of just the sentiment and what have you. So I think that's going to hurt, and that's why you have some of the utilities that have outperformed that are in the alternative space, while some of these others have dramatically underperformed. So again, it goes back to the winner and loser, categories more so than the specific sector.
You think the bank turmoil is behind us? A couple times we've thought that, and then we saw another bank fail. But it does seem like Wall Street is pretty sure that all the banks right now have enough assets to pay out depositors if they need to.
Yeah, I think the worst is behind us, Matt. I think it's a matter, you know, if something else, you know, arose, then again, the area that's going to get hit are the areas you want to avoid anyway. But actually, you know, a J.P. Morgan is going to be stronger, and that's why you want to be in a J.P. Morgan or a Goldman Sachs, you know. And if we're wrong and things escalate and get worse, but yeah, I think the majority of it's behind us, and it's just going to be a one-off type event, you know, from here on in. I don't see it really becoming a contagion, you know, or anything disastrous, you know, especially in the U.S.
Hey, listen, you know, one of the things that you've liked in the past is in, you know, the travel and hospitality space, and I'm thinking about Airbnb, which is getting hammered today. Is that an opportunity, or have you guys suggested people be out of it ahead of this earnings? Where are you on that?
Yeah, we liked Airbnb in the 80s, and you know, obviously the stock rose, you know, quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So if it falls back a few more days like today, and we'd be back and buying, it's a long term, you know, hold, you know, at these levels. But again, it shows the importance of taking profits. We took some profits in Treehouse Foods, something we talked about a year ago, and went from the 30s to the 50s, and we think, you know, it could be taken over, but we're probably looking at a $60 price, and it's not, you know, worth it in the mid-50s anymore to hold on. So, yeah, that's a good point. I think as the market sees this volatility in winners and losers, mm-hmm. you know, take some profits, at least partial profits on some of these winners.
What do you think about Apple coming to the market for bonds when they already have $170 billion in cash? You know, they only offer a 0.5% dividend yield, which
it's good to be
I don't
Apple.
Get. You know, I know they do big buybacks, you know, 70, 80, maybe $100 billion this year. But how do you feel as a shareholder?
Yeah, you know, the company's great. You know, I feel real, you know, comfortable with it. We're not buying it at this level. I mean, you know, our average cost is far lower. But you know, we did buy, you know, Alphabet when it went down, and we did actually buy some Amazon. So some of the mega caps we did buy it at the end of last year, not Apple. Apple has really held up pretty well and never got into buying territory, unfortunately for us.
Alan, I'm just curious because we've got Disney reporting after the close, and just kind of springing this on you. Just got about 30 seconds left here. Is Disney a name that's on your radar?
If it continued to weaken, we'd look at it, but it's not one of our favorites. I think there's a lot of other areas. I think streaming, you know, those type of stocks, you have to be worrisome. And I never really understood that concept from unbundling, and now you get all these different streaming services. So I'd be a little bit cautious. But again, you know, if it weakened enough, it is a high quality company, but nothing that we'd be buying at current levels.
All right. Well, fun to check in with you. Really appreciate it. Alan Lance, Director of Research at LanceGlobal.com. President Alan B. Lance and Associates on the phone from Toledo, Ohio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast.
Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.